Blog Talk Radio.
I'm your host, Merle Exit. Let's see, what do we got here? I'm in New York City. It's 2:30 in the afternoon. It's cloudy, but the weather is nice. Temperature is nice. But I'm inside doing the radio show, so I'm not sure. But, okay, so today we're going to head back to Michigan once more for a contemporary museum known as MOCAD. And we're going to have Greg, I think it's pronounced Bias or Base, I'll find out in a minute. He's going to give us a tour of what was a former car sales building. And then, okay, I mean, if you're going to have a fairy tale brownie, you might as well wash it down with a glass of milk. But is all milk the same? Does it matter where it comes from? Does it matter where it's local? Well, we're going to have Daniel Horan from 5 Acre Farms, and he's going to discuss his product, which is they call local. And we're going to also talk about milk and the differences in content as well. So before I have my first guest, well, I mean, no, I'm going to play it. I'll play it before I have my second guest. I won't do the Fairy Tale Brownies commercial. What we're going to do right now is go right to MOCAD. Hello, Greg.
Hey, Merle. Hey there.
So, tell us, first introduce yourself.
Okay, my name is Greg Bays, and I am the curator of public programs at Museum of Contemporary Art Detroit. That means I work with music and other performing arts and film and artist talks. And, you know, we try to keep things pretty engaging and busy around the museum.
Now, I understand the museum was something else prior.
Yeah. I mean, prehistory, it was an indoor car showroom right on Woodward Avenue, which is the main street of Detroit. It's one end is at the Detroit River, and the other end is 30 miles away in Pontiac, Michigan, the straight shot. But we're in a neighborhood called Midtown, very nearby to the Detroit Institute of Arts, which is our gigantic art museum that's been in the news a lot lately. And also Wayne State University. MOCAD opened about 8 years ago, and it's been a really great addition to the cultural landscape of Detroit.
So, okay, so what makes this different from, I mean, I went on a whirlwind tour of art museums. What makes this one different from most of them?
First of all, we're a Kunsthalle. We aren't a collecting institution. So either our curators or independent curators are coming up with shows that are specific for our galleries and exhibition spaces, or else occasionally we will get a touring show. But we aren't a collecting institution, and we are dedicated to art from, you know, right now, contemporary, as well as some artists who sometimes are overlooked from the recent past, or our major artists from right now. For instance, outside of our facilities, on the other side of our parking lot, in what was formerly just a, you know, like a lawn or grass or whatever, that's now the location of Mike Kelly's mobile homestead. It was the last major project that Mike Kelly was working on in his lifetime. And he came to Detroit. Mike was originally from the Detroit area, and growing up as a freak in Detroit, like a lot of us did, that left a lasting impression on his work. I mean, he moved to L.A. in the 70s. There was always an element of, or many elements from his, Detroit culture in his work. And we are the permanent home for the mobile homestead, which is part community center and part exhibition space and part private studios for artists as well. It's a facsimile, a full-scale facsimile of the home he grew up in suburban Detroit. And it just opened in May, and it's already off to a really great and intriguing and interesting start.
And so this is because, I mean, for those who don't know who he is he just
Mike
a
Kelly was
artist,
one of the most
so
prominent. Oh, no. Mike Kelly was an art world superstar. He was one of the most influential American artists of the past two decades. Unfortunately, he passed away about 2 years ago, but he had so many plans and ideas for mobile homestead that through a lot of work and dedication and perseverance between the Mike Kelly Studios, now the Mike Kelly Foundation for the Arts, and Art Angel, which is a really great art funding organization from the United Kingdom, LUMA, which is another art funding organization from Switzerland, and the efforts of the staff at the Museum of Contemporary Art Detroit, we were able to create it and build it, and it's there, and it's here for the long haul.
Now, I wanted to ask just to clarify something, by the way. When you say non-collectible, what does...
Non-collecting. Yeah, MoCAD doesn't... so take the Detroit Institute of Arts or the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, or most things that we think of as museums have collections. They have artwork that they buy. They have artwork that has been donated to them. And they've had artwork that has been made specifically for them. We aren't like that. And if, you know, our shows are up for a couple of, a couple of months. We have three seasons. And the art afterwards is either returned to the artist, it's been lent, or in some cases it's like ephemeral installation art. It's created for the exhibition, but afterwards it's destroyed. It's not something that's meant to be bought and sold. For instance, we did a show with the great American kind of like underground punk rock cartoon comic artist and also painter and set designer, Gary Cantor. And he worked in collaboration with Joshua White, who is a legendary rock and roll lighting engineer from the 60s and beyond. He did the lights at Woodstock, the crazy psychedelic stuff on the cover of Iron Butterfly's In a God of the Vita. That iconic imagery is his. And they came and transformed the gallery of MoCAD into this psychedelic light show funhouse. And see, there are a lot of lights involved, and there are also like sculptural and architectural elements that were made specifically for MoCAD. It was actually, I mean, Gary is an art world person, but it was Joshua White's basically first foray into a fine art museum. But once it was done, you know, we disposed of it. We had to, you know, shred the wallpaper and return the lights that we had rented. So we're not a collecting institution. That's not part of our mission. Our mission is to, part of our mission is to expose the community, both locally and we have national and international visitors, to great pieces of contemporary art.
So in other words, it would be classified if you were going to a museum as what's listed as what's on exhibit versus the collection. So in other words,
right,
everything
right.
you have is on exhibit.
That is correct. Okay.
And so, which means, am I assuming that, let's say, if I came back in 3 or 4 months or whatever, everything would be completely different?
That's correct. And not only that, but through the great work of Zeb Smith and Jonathan Rojewski, who are our exhibitions team, they adapt the facilities to fit and work with whatever the current exhibition is. So they're always building walls and tearing down walls and putting in projection rooms and video screening rooms. It's a very malleable space, and that's one of it's been noted. People are very impressed that, you know, when art comes in to be exhibited at MOCAD, it doesn't have to be squeezed into different places. Things are made and modified for the best possible exhibition experience.
Now, when I was there, I noticed like there were two particular spots where there were some screenings going on. Do they just get substituted?
Well, sometimes it depends. I mean, like I said, walls come up, the walls are built and walls are taken down depending on the needs of the exhibition. And right now, though, and for, you know, in a definite period, our curator, Jens Hoffman, in collaboration with several curators around the world, have come up with an idea called B-Drome. And it is an online platform where every 2 weeks they put on, online, they display a piece of contemporary video art. And MOCAD is the home of a brick-and-mortar screening room for V-Drome. And so whatever is online is also being screened in this room. And it's a single-channel video projection. I mean, there's a lot of different ways of displaying and different video artists work in different ways. But basically, we're talking about single-channel video projections right now. And this is the place where you can come and visit and see works by different video artists. And we've also had a commitment to video art since the beginning. We've had shows with Yes for Youth and Henri Sala, and also we've had shows that have integrated video elements, whether it's for reference or as part of the exhibition. But yeah, right now, the one room where, I don't know if you visited when the Mobile Homestead videos and documentation were up, but we had a room that had Mike Kelly's Mobile Homestead videos being projected. And we've used a little bit of adapting, but now that's the home of V-Drome.
Mm-hmm. Then there's also I didn't realize what it was. I thought there was just cleaning up from an event or something like that. And I didn't realize until I looked into it that particular room is the cafe.
Oh, there's a cafe room, too. And the cafe... the cafe isn't. We have a cafe there, and it's has a pretty substantial size. But it's not really. It's not part of our exhibition space. When we have shows there, generally there's nothing in the cafe that's on display. It's part of the exhibition. However, that's where my particular, bread and butter is, as it were. That's where we do a lot of our performances and film screenings, like one-off programs, which I am the curator of, and I work with the other staff, curatorial staff at the museum to present stuff that makes sense for the museum itself, and oftentimes with the exhibitions in particular. So we just had Kim Gordon and Bill Mays perform there a couple nights ago at Bodyhead, and they made amazing improvisational noise music that would meander in and out of song. And also had a video element going on, too, with a video projection from the gigantic white wall behind them. And then the next day we had Matej Jankovic, who is a avant-garde writer and publisher, and he gave a reading on Thursday night. And then tonight we have Mary Savandi, who is a pretty fantastic artist from South Africa, and she'll be giving a talk about her work there tonight. So again, it's a very flexible room, depending on its needs.
So it sounds to me like sort of like the cafe, the Greenwich Village scene kind of thing. You're not going in to see some star performer kind of thing. There's no show, you know.
The thing about the cafe is, like, especially with our great cafe staff, we've really stepped it up and have been more consistent with just the cafe's existence, with offering fine coffee and good food and pop-up restaurants that are local, healthy, and delicious. And also the cafe is working on kind of its own programming as well. There's going to be a trivia night there on October 10th. And also, actually, this coming Sunday on the 29th, a local culinary figure, Nick George, who goes by the name Dr. Sushi, he's hosted sushi pop-up restaurants at the cafe, at the Moquette Cafe, and also elsewhere around Detroit. But this Sunday, he's actually giving a sushi-making class, and patrons can come, and they pay $30, and he teaches them about sushi and how to make sushi. And then at the end, everyone gets to eat what they've made.
Well, that sounds cool. So it's completely, it's a whole different space from, like, going to the Met.
Although, I mean, there's similarities and differences. I mean, we're a lot smaller. I think we're 22,000 square feet, I think it's the number. Maybe it's there. I'm not sure. But, you know, it's cozy. It's definitely cozy.
That's a good word. It is. It's a cozy space. It's not, and it's kind of like nothing you really have to, I don't think you really, unless you're, I guess, going to an event. Do you have to make reservations when you go to the events, by the way?
A lot of the events are ticketed, so people buy their tickets in advance. I mean, we had hundreds of people come out to see Ken Gordon and Domaes. And you know, they have been, I mean, it's already music, and they played the previous night at the MCA in Chicago, but they also have played at places like St. Vitus in New York, the heavy metal club. And, you know, they're no strangers from the rock world and the noise scene and everything, but we're a museum, and we were able to accommodate them. Very popular, very much in the news and everything, so people bought their tickets in advance. Also, for a reading or something, you know, people just show up because it's not ticketed.
Oh, that's great. It's like for people also, like, kind of for some last minute thing, like, what's happening tonight? I want to get out of the house, and, you know, I feel like paying well to see a Broadway type show. let's just go and relax and get together with some friends and sit in the cafe, and whatever's going on is fine.
Well, actually, it's more like, you know, the cafes, the cafes open during the day, and people come for coffee or for lunch or for meetings or things like this. On Thursdays and Fridays, we're open until 8, but then there's also the special programming afterwards, and it's usually not really like a last-minute thing. And the thing is, it's like the stuff that we have going on here is stuff that people are excited about. A lot of times it's stuff that they can't believe is happening anywhere, let alone at MOCAD. I mean, that's how it was with Kim and Tim Gordon and Bill Mace. That's how it was this summer with Wire, who, you know, the legendary British arch rock punk band kicked off their American tour at the MOCAD, and everyone was just so thrilled, from the audience to the band themselves, to be playing at this modern art space. And Wire hadn't played in Detroit in 25 years. And I'm going to dare say that there were definitely more people at the MOCAD performance than there were 25 years ago when they played in the mid-80s. But that's something that's just been really exciting for me, to be involved with MOCAD and have the opportunity to work on these, you know, these kind of lofty, and just working on these artists that I couldn't imagine, you know, booking anywhere, and yet we have these facilities here, we have this reputation. And so, for instance, for Tao, we have the Los Angeles electronic noise music supergroup called Extended Organ. They're going to be performing on November 8th, and Friday, November 8th at MOCAD. And they barely perform live, like in a concert setting, anywhere. They're all more or less based in Los Angeles and have been active in both sound art and visual art since the 70s. And, you know, they might play in Los Angeles maybe once or twice a year at places like the Getty or LACMA or the Box Gallery. And yet we have them coming here. All these people, so the group Extended Organ is the quartet of Paul McCartney, the very, you know, prominent art world superstar, major American artist, just had that huge show, WS at the Armory, you know, that totally amazing and notorious video artist, installation artist, sculptor, performance artist. He is part of this group. Freddie Nielsen, who is a very prominent portrait photographer and art documentarian. Tom Rashawn, who's a great graphic designer, and Rick Potts, who is an instrument builder. They all collaborate together to make avant-garde noise and drone music, and they're all very close with Mike Kelly. Mike Kelly was actually, when he was alive, was also part of this ensemble, and when we invited them to perform at MOCAD, it wasn't how are we going to do this, it was when. We want to do this. We want to come there and perform, and I couldn't be more thrilled.
Now, one of the things I also wanted to touch on, by the way, is the particular exhibit that was, and I don't know how to call it. I guess it was kind of like sort of poster boards kind of thing. I don't know.
Are you talking about the past is present? The mural show?
Yes, that was the one. Yes.
The current show is called The Past is Present, and it is a mural show, and that's wood, that's plywood. We actually built it. It's a mural, it's evocative of a mural. These are freestanding, I think they're like 8x12 pieces of wood that are on big stands distributed through the room. There's 14, I think, of them, there's 14. And what it is here in Detroit, we have, at the Detroit Institute of Arts, we have a mural, we have Diego Rivera's Detroit Industry Murals, which very much is acknowledged as his masterpiece. He's an amazing muralist, and here in Detroit, we have, you know, it's just like this overwhelming, beautiful, politically engaging, educational mural on Detroit industry. And Diego Rivera finished those murals in 1933. So 80 years later, our curator, Dan Zoffman, approached a bunch of artists internationally and asked them for ideas from Detroit history, but from 1933 onwards. So we have a lot of subject matter dealing with labor activism and with civil rights, and with Detroit, you know, culture, music culture, and visual art culture, issues of gentrification, and the bankruptcy that we're dealing with right now, too. These are all present in The Past is Present, which the title comes from the Detroit Historical Society, which has a museum right up the street from us. Their slogan or their catchphrase is, "Where the Detroit, you know, the Detroit Historical Museum, where the past is present." And so we just took Jens, who has a great way with words, wordplay, just truncated it and just said the past is present. And, you know, you can look at it on many different levels, but it's a really, you know, great show with artwork that was, you know, the ideas came internationally from people like Martha Rosler and Claire Fontaine, the collector from France. And they were actually painted and executed by local Detroit artists. So it was definitely like a a show that's both local and international in scope.
Mm-hmm. Has the bankruptcy, now this is Detroit, right, that's bankrupt, how has affected the museum, or has it?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say it's, I can't single out the museum in particular. I mean, it's affecting everyone. It's almost like we're in limbo. Not, I mean, we, as someone that lives in Detroit, we're in limbo. Like, who knows what's really going to happen? I mean, everyone's kind of biding their time and seeing what's going to happen, how it's going to happen. You know, are the powers that be going to honor their commitments to the people that worked and their pensions, or are, you know, what, you don't know how it's going to play out. In the meantime, the MOCAD is, you know, pretty much a private institution with, you know, getting money from national grants and from, you know, patrons and donors and such. We're not a municipal organization. Let's put it that way. So, I mean, we're doing the best that we can. We've always been trying to engage and connect with the people in the neighborhood and in the region so that, you know, they know about our facilities and our resources, and they can come and learn. And, you know, we just want it to be accessible. And like I said, it's always been there, but it just feels like now more than ever, there's a push for people to know how important the arts are in culture. A couple of years ago, with the Detroit Institute of Arts, they passed the millage. Like, people voluntarily voted to increase their own taxes to help support the Detroit Institute of Arts. So people around here know how important institutions like MOCAD are to the community, to our daily lives. So it's always a struggle. I mean, it'd be a struggle even without bankruptcy, but like I said, we're doing the best that we can.
So in other words, it's sort of the bankruptcy kind of boils down to things that have to do with governmental things, municipal.
I mean, that's part of it, but I mean, it's going to affect everyone.
Yeah.
You know, there's issues of privatization and also of exploitation, and you know, it's hard to say what's going to happen. And whatever's happening, it's happening really slowly. So it's going to be a while before the results are in.
Okay. What is the website?
Our website is mocadetroit.org, mocadetroit.org.
Okay. And I guess, and you said that you have a you could watch a B-roll, you said, to the...
Oh, V-Drome, yeah. On our website, you have links to the current exhibitions and all of our past exhibitions, to upcoming performances and film showings and such, and also all the stuff that we've done in the past, so you can see how much we've accomplished over the past 7 or 8 years. And we have a great crew of documentarians, and many of the performances, they aren't on display necessarily in their entirety, but, you know, there's nice, succinct clips on our YouTube channel displaying some of the different performers that have been at MOCAD over the years.
Okay, that's great. Well, I thank you so much for calling in and sharing this information, and in case I missed anything in the article that I wrote. Because I'm almost done, not quite done, with this trip of getting people on the radio to share even more information that I got or missed. But this is great. It's nice to in terms of fine arts to be able to have it varied of the type that you see, because you never know, you know, what's pleasing to the eye or not, or, you know, and not all art has to be recognized. In other words, you don't have to say, oh, well, if it's not a Picasso, I don't know what it is. So it doesn't have to
be. Absolutely. I mean, you know, what is a lot of what we talk about, just, you know, among my colleagues in the art world, is just, you know, art forms of the present. And so much of it is conceptual. We earlier this year, we had a survey of about 80 different great people working in conceptual art. And there was a lot to look at the show. There was definitely a lot to think about, but there were also pieces of art that didn't have any material form. You know, you had to look at what was going on in the catalog. So we have all these things, but then we also have our current show is a mural show. I mean, these are murals, these are paintings, and they are very specific to Detroit too. So, you know, combined with just the art that's on display and the educational signs and our educational staff, there's a lot to talk about, both just with the art world, but also politically and what's going on in Detroit. And just encourage people to come and visit. And there's a lot to see. It's really rewarding, you know, if you spend time with it, or if you only have a little bit of time and can only see a couple things here or there. But if it pays off, just like, you know, just like any museum exhibition, with repeated viewings, repeated visiting, immersing yourself in it.
Okay. Thank you so much, Greg. We'll send people after, or when they go to
Great.
Detroit, to, you know, to make sure they don't miss this place.
Excellent. We appreciate it, Merle.
As a find, as I call it.
Excellent.
Have a great day, and thank you so
okay.
much again.
Thank you, Merle. All right, bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. Okay. Well, I'm going to have to put my this is the perfect commercial. And by the way, I just want to interject that I just got some late breaking news. It seems that despite Governor Christie in New Jersey, it looks like same-sex marriage is going to be legal now in New Jersey. They just added yet another state. Anyway, so this has to be here's my favorite commercial.
What would you do to earn brownie points? How about treating someone to what may be the best brownies they've ever tasted? Fairy Tale Brownies. They may seem like one of the richest bars of fudge, with varieties that include caramel, chocolate chip, espresso nib, raspberry swirl, mint chocolate, all made with Calbo dark Belgian chocolate. But yes, they are brownies. And that's no fairy tale.
Oh, yes, and you can get these wonderful brownies at www.brownies.com. And what's the best way to wash down the brownies? But with a glass of milk. But not all milk is the same. As a matter of fact, we got Daniel Horan. Is it Horan or Horan?
It's Horan.
Horan. Well, go introduce yourself. And by the way, I was going to have the milk next to me while we did this. Sorry, I'm a milkaholic. I already drank it down. But go introduce yourself.
Good. Well, I'm Dan Horan. I'm the president and CEO of 5 Acre Farms. We're a local food brand that you can find in the supermarket. We go and find farms that we like within 275 miles of your store, and we pay the farmers properly and directly, and then we tell their stories. Our first products were milk, as you alluded to, Merle, and we also do apple juice, applesauce, apple cider, and eggs. But milk was our first item. We do whole, reduced, and skim, as well as half and half and heavy cream.
Now, how did you, like, what made you decide to get into this?
Well, I've been in the food and farming business for my whole career. I started out after college and started in 1990, started an organic vegetable business, which my brothers still run and farm. So I farmed full-time for a while. I was in the grocery business for a little while. I moved to New York. My girlfriend, then now wife, came to school here. So I was in the grocery business, spent a little time in the in the restaurant business, but really all along had been thinking that there were a lot of good farms and farmers out there and a lot of good products that weren't reaching the public because of the way the industry worked, and that it really wasn't that hard to change that. So I had that idea a while ago, and 4 years ago decided, or in 2010 decided, maybe 3 years ago, decided to put that into action and started 5 Acre Farms.
How does it make a difference of where the farmer is in terms of distance?
Well, there are a couple things. The first is that I really believe in the ideas of local economy. And so having things that are nearby to you within half a day's drive or so, particularly if it's feasible to do. I mean, for example, I wouldn't open a banana farm in Connecticut, but there's a lot of milk and there are a lot of apples. And so proximity is important, because I think one of the things that's been lost in food is a connection to the source. So knowing who your farmer is used to not be such a foreign idea. Now we know about that less and less. And there's really no reason for that, in my estimation. So the proximity matters, but in terms of the product, it's less about the proximity and more about the farming practices.
So now, would you kind of say the not necessarily organic, correct?
No, it's not organic, but we look for farmers that use sustainable practices. And one of the first things the sustainable means to me is keeping a farm in business. And farms, we've lost 88% of our dairies in the last 30 years in this country. So whatever the system was, quote unquote, just was simply not working. But as it turns out, there are a lot of farmers who aren't necessarily organic, but are good stewards of the land and maybe don't comply with everything that would make it organic. But that's just on the practices. But on the practical matter, the other, and even though I own an organic farm, so I come from organic farming, as much as I love organic farming, it's often quite expensive. And just because of food being too expensive, it often people just don't buy organic, not because it's what they want, but because they don't have the money for it. So there are a lot of really good farmers that, while they're not organic, do things that are just slightly less expensive. They're not necessarily bad. So sustainable is a farmer that has good practices, one a farmer that's open, a farmer that's willing to explain what they do, willing to improve. And so those are the things. Treats their animals well, that's a very important thing. Takes care of their manure, make sure it doesn't go into the groundwater and pollute streams. That's a very real issue for farmers, and one that people care about. So that's what a sustainable farmer is.
Okay. Now, all right, I'm a milkaholic. I don't know if you heard.
I like to hear that. I like to hear that.
But it's, when I say milkaholic, it's like, all right, some people like it when they're in certain different moods and they take a shot of booze.
Yeah.
I take a shot of milk.
Well, how have you enjoyed our milk?
I have to tell you something. This is really very funny, because the one milk, there's only one that I absolutely hate, is skim milk.
Okay.
I hate it because it's like I might as well just use water. It's just like it doesn't do anything for me. And I went, okay, but you have one. It doesn't say skim. It says fat-free. And I understand that there's a difference. What is the difference, by the way?
No, actually, it's really just the terms are used interchangeably. The federal government says that skim milk or fat-free milk can have no more than a certain percent of butter fat in the milk, and then reduced fat, which is often referred to as 2%, has the same thing, and then whole milk also has to have a minimum amount of butter fat. So it really refers to the butter fat.
Mm-hmm.
So I think our skim milk tastes great, but I think it's for reasons that have less to do with the fat and more to do with how the animals are treated.
Aha! Now, you had to see me because I'm going, all right, the first one I'm going to taste is the non-fat to see how bad it is. So I put some in the glass. I went, all right, I'll sip a little first. And I took the first sip. I went, what? Doesn't taste like skim milk. Wait a minute. So I continued, and I went, you know, I can really deal with getting this non-fat. It just didn't have that, I guess, I don't know what to call it. It's like a watery taste to it, like it was nothing. I mean, I tasted milk.
That's right. That's right. Well, there's no reason why you shouldn't. And actually, on the other end, our whole milk is just the milk that comes out of the cow, period. We don't really, there's a federal minimum, but we just serve whatever milk comes out. And that, as it turns out, is often higher than what other places, if the milk is ever higher in butter fat, they take it out so they can use it for other things. We just leave it in.
Does that mean I'm going to get the cream at the top when I open it up?
No, that has to do with how it's homogenized, and we do homogenize milk, so a milk that has a cream at the top hasn't been homogenized. That's all that means.
So in other words, when I was a kid and I got the milk in the bottle delivered at the door, those are milk that was, not that I even knew where it came from, you know, it was the milkman came. Well, my
That's
mother
right.
had the milkman come to deliver
well,
the milk.
Then that was certainly all local milk, and it just means it wasn't homogenized.
Uh-huh.
And the public, you know, there's a lot of people say, oh, there's nothing like cream-lined milk, which is what I would call non-homogenized milk, and it's truly delicious. A lot of times people don't like after a couple of days, when the cream clumps up, they don't like how that looks in their coffee, or they don't like how it looks on top of the bottle. It's cream. You know, it's perfectly... That's yummy.
I haven't gotten to the whole to the whole milk. I've been playing with a lot of the other things, though. But I've been taste testing, like with coffee, to see how I, you know. And one of the things that I thought about, because in my head I'm going, well, I could always put in non-fat milk and then just add a little touch of half and half to give it a better taste kind of thing.
Mm.
But I didn't have to. But so these were, you know, these are the kind of thoughts that I was having. Now, can we kind of go through, like, all right, what would you use, like, half and half for? Oh, I think I lost you. This is what happened. Okay, this is what happens when you have somebody. Okay, he must be on his cell phone. Are you back again? Okay. Are you back? You're back. We lost you a second.
I'm back.
Okay. So give me some ideas of... No, before I even get into that, what exactly is milk that... For people who are lactose intolerant, what does that mean?
So there's there's lactose is in milk, and you can remove it through chemistry and still have a milk-like substance. That's not something, that's not a business that we're in.
No, I know.
But it's often, and I think that actually there are probably a number of people that are lactose intolerant will tell you that for some reason, if they were to drink raw milk, they would be okay. So lactose intolerance is I think, turning out to be a little more complex than people think. But that's the principle idea, that there's the basic element of milk, not the basic element, but an element of milk is lactose. And I think it's somewhere between 5 and 8%. I don't know the exact percent of the population is has an allergy to it.
Oh, okay. See, one of the things that that I guess I must be that I'm sensitive to is what I would say the sugar that's in the milk, if you want to call it sugar, because what happens is that like normally, like let's say if I had something like coffee, and I'm not a big coffee drinker, but it's like if I have coffee. And I use milk. I could kind of tell. Do I need sugar? Do I not need sugar? And I had noticed that there was enough of a, if you want to call it sweetness, that I didn't even bother. That wouldn't have to use sugar. Then I started going. If I get enough sweetness in the non-fat. I have to be very careful. It's like I'm ready to open up the cream and take a sip and enjoy. But I'm saying, no, I'll have to do something creative with it. Matter of fact, that's what I want to talk about, creativity in the types of the dairy products.
Mm-hmm.
What you would use it for, like the half and half of the cream.
Half and half for cream. Well, that's really more of my colleague Gemma, who's a chef. She could tell you who you met, I believe, at the Taste of Queens. But certainly for soups and for dressings, sauces would be the principal uses. You can use cream to make butter. You can use cream to make butter and then take the buttermilk and add those to pancakes. So there are all sorts of uses for cream, and half and half is our half and half is a 15% butterfat content. Most half and halves out there are 11. Most milk products today really are designed to meet some sort of federal standard rather than what they actually are. It's kind of an interesting change in the business, but. So those would be the reasons. Those would be the things we would use half and half and heavy cream for tea or coffee.
What about now? If you were to make ice cream, what would you be using?
You'd be using cream, a little bit of milk, but mostly cream. Ice cream, I think, by definition, has to have a minimum of butterfat. I think it's 10%. To get the binding. Otherwise, it's more icy.
Right.
Right. So you would use it to make ice cream as well. And so the better ice creams all have a higher cream content, or the better the if you were to put all the ice creams on the table, the creamiest, most delicious would all have the higher cream content.
So because of the content in the half and half, can you make ice cream from half and half? Or you'd still find it a little watery?
No, I think you. I think you could actually. I don't know that answer, but certainly because
okay.
By the butter. Well, I think the answer is yes.
Well, I'll experiment and let you know. I'm also ice cream addict too. But it's got to be good stuff though.
Yeah, it's not good. Bother.
Right. I'm not the kind of person, you know, that I go into the store and because Breyers is on sale, I'm going, no way. Not going to have all that air. Just want a good tasting ice cream. And I'll pay for it. Now, I also want to get into a couple of other things. Very interesting is the eggs I had. All right, I taste tested. Here was my taste test. I made a couple of hard-boiled eggs. And I said, how would it taste without any salt or pepper or anything? And that's what I did. And I tasted and I went, really? Can really taste the egg and the freshness of the egg? I don't need anything to bring it out or cover it up with. How come?
That's good to hear. So it sounds like we passed the first stage of Merle's taste test on eggs.
Yes. Well, what's special about these eggs?
So there are a couple of principal factors in what is going to make an egg taste good. I think probably the very first one is how fresh it is. And luckily for us, we get eggs to market extremely fast. Eggs in the first couple of days don't even really need to be refrigerated. In the U.S., we require that, but a fresh egg can last 4 or 5 days out of refrigeration. So one of the things that we try to do is we try to deliver eggs to order, and we try to have supermarkets not order for 2 or 3 or 4 weeks worth, because they'll last in a refrigerator for 6 or 7 weeks. We want them to order weekly. So I think the first thing is the freshness. I think the second is the diet that the birds are fed contributes to that, and certainly the variety of chickens, although ours are not of any special variety that is particularly unique. So what they're fed, and those are really the main ingredients to having a good egg. I think there probably is something, and I don't know what, to the conditions of the birds. Certainly these are cage-free, and I think if you've had chickens from birds that are only outside, that's sort of the ideal. There are a lot of things that are very challenging to do that on a scale to feed a lot of people. But I think what we're witnessing now in this country is a return to looking for better tasting eggs. And then the other, I think the quality, the shell, having a good hard shell also protects the eggs. And the egg is porous. The eggshell is porous. It lets in air over time. And so a very thin egg is going to start to change inside. So I think those are the factors that we just, the first one being we just deliver a very, very fresh egg, and that's what you're tasting.
I'm glad, because that's then I won't get, yelled at for in case I'm eating too much salt or get bloated. Now, the next topic I want to go into is about sell-by dates. How are they determined, and at what point? How are they determined?
That's interesting. Sell-by dates, I think, are largely arbitrary numbers. They're largely arbitrary dates that, on a very, very general level, are very useful guides to consumers. And guide to public health policy people about when is a safe time to consume this. So the first thing, they're really, they're measures of assurance about how safe it is what you're eating. So that's the first principle of any of these sell-by dates. They don't address how things are handled. You could have buy milk with a 17-day shelf life, and if you left it out of your refrigerator, or if the supermarket left it out, then it would only last a couple of days. And, we've all had experience with something like that where
yes.
Yeah, and so in industry terms, the cold chain. You know, was there a break in the cold chain when it came out of the cow? Did it immediately get down to temperature to 38, 40 degrees? Was it kept in a refrigerator? Was the truck refrigerated? When it went to the supermarket, did it sit on the back dock for 6 hours, or did it immediately go into the refrigerator? When it went into the case on the shelf, you know, when you drove home, did you leave it in your car for an hour? When you walked home, did you run three errands and leave it out? So the sell-by date is from the point of purchase, is supposed to give you an indication of its safety. It varies, and I mean, one thing that we found, and this is true for all milks, a milk that is very, very clean will have a much longer date than milk that isn't so clean. And without getting too much into what clean means, but as milk is handled, milk is a wonderful thing to grow all sorts of bad things in. Milk's loaded with nutrition, and bacteria love to feast on it. But if it's processed very cleanly, it takes that bacteria a long time to actually make anything. If it's processed where the tanks aren't cleaned right or it's left warm, then things grow very, very fast in it. And so a high-quality milk should last, if it's been kept cold, well past the shelf dates. With eggs, it's the same. Again, it's really more of a matter of public health. But unfortunately, there's little guide on how fresh it is because it's quite a long date. I mean, generally, when you buy eggs, you want to buy as far out as possible, and in the 6 to 7 week range. But often you can't get that. Often your supermarket doesn't, you know, they have plenty of eggs in the back to last them for a couple of weeks, and that's really the way that business works. In the cider business, early in the season, you might get 21 or 24 days when you make cider. And towards the end of the season, when you're making cider in February and March, you might only get 14. And that's just because the apples naturally begin a decaying process, and the wild yeasts that are eating the sugar activate much faster. So sell-by date, first and foremost, I think is something for public health and extremely important. But depending on the product, may or may not be that useful.
Now, does it make a difference? Let's just say I have a long sell-by date, and now I have a refrigerator, and I open up the product, and I'm using it. Does it, even though it's refrigerated, does it still?
It does shorten. Yeah, it's short. You know, once you open things up, the clock really does start to tick. But with milk, you should get a long life. You should certainly get to the sell-by date with a good quality milk. I mean, most of the better quality milks out there, you'll get many, many days past. I mean, with our milk, we'll often get 10 days past the date. We can't print that, but
right.
That's
okay.
The...
Now, one of the things is that I was told this, and this is how I test out eggs,
mm-hmm.
to see how fresh they are. It's like, okay, they've been in the refrigerator a while. So it's still good. And you're supposed to, like, put the egg in a pot of water and see if it floats.
Right. So a good egg should sink. And really, what happens is I mentioned earlier that eggshells are porous, and air is getting in to an eggshell very, very slowly. But if it's been around for 4 or 5 weeks, it still may be safe to consume, but it is not fresh. And really what you see is the air has seeped in and is now inside the shell, and that's why it floats.
So does it make a difference then, let's say, the way you put it in the refrigerator? Are you better off, like, putting it so no air is getting in?
No, because in the fridge it's going to get in. It's everywhere, anywhere you are, the air is it's going to get in. As soon as it's out of the bird, air is going to get in.
Okay.
There. It's just so the Europeans, and not only Europeans, but many cultures all over the world, they don't refrigerate their eggs at all because they eat them within 3 or 4 days. You know, the egg just got laid. I put it in the cupboard, but I always eat fresh eggs because I know after 4 or 5 days, air will start to get in and start to change the chemistry inside the egg. We know that when it's refrigerated, that happens much, much slower, and that's why it can go 6-7 weeks in the refrigerator. But the best time to eat an egg is in the first few days.
Okay. So how about, I mean, like, are you, like, better off saying, well, let me take about, I don't know how long I'm going to last. Maybe I should take about a half a dozen and hard boil them and then put them in the refrigerator.
That's a good question. You know, I don't really know the answer to that. It just, I think it more depends on what you plan on using them for. That's a good question, though. I don't know. I mean, certainly when you cook them, you removed a lot of problems with eggs or with anything. When you cook it, you over 180 degrees, you're in effect pasteurizing it. Whether that's a good way, I mean, I think because eggs, a lot of recipes call for raw eggs, you might be.
Oh, yeah. I don't mean, you know, I'm just talking about having breakfast kind of thing.
Oh, I see. You know, I'll have to get back to you on that. We'll look that up and send you an email on that. I don't know the answer to that.
Okay. That's okay. You don't have to know. You don't have to know the answer to everything. I'm just having stuff popping in my brain is because I cook a lot. So these are all like thoughts and also when I'm going shopping. Now, when you say in terms of where the location of the farm is, you're talking, if you're putting in, let's say your zip code and you're in Detroit, is that
right?
Does that work as well, or this is something that's dealing with New York?
For 5-acre farms, we've started out in the Northeast. Eventually, we may be all over the country, but I think a general guide for anybody who lives in Detroit or Chicago or Cleveland or Nashville or Memphis is to try to source things, particularly if they're available locally. That's one of the big ideas behind 5-acre farms. As I mentioned earlier, it's not practical or possible to get local bananas up here. So why bother? But it is possible, and there are plenty around to get good eggs, apples, milk, vegetables for a lot of the year, potatoes, onions, and focusing on those will often bring things. We'll often make things fresher, although the wonders of today's transportation, really, it's amazing how quickly things get here from California. But also, you'll have a lot more of a relationship of where your food comes from, and often that will lead to a higher quality. And one of our missions is to keep farmers farming. Particularly good ones, and so keeping farmers around by buying their products is a good thing. I think the bargain there is they have to be somewhat affordable.
So, but as far as, let's say, I know, like, your products are in Fairway Markets,
mm-hmm.
and so I can go to the one in Douglaston and buy it. But it's called local. Will people be able to go to, is this only like in the tri-state area that this particular?
No, we've started out in the Northeast, so we're in New Jersey and in places like Fairway and ShopRite and King supermarkets, and you can see us in New York in everything from union markets to some key foods, some met foods, and then Mrs. Green's Market, which is a big presence there, about 14 of them in Westchester. So I would say the New York Metro Market is where
okay.
we've started. For many, many, there are a lot of mouths to feed in that area, so should we be so lucky to get further than that?
Would you happen to know? I'm just curious. Would the prices vary depending on where you're buying it or who's having it on sale?
That's really up to the retailer. That's very difficult for us to control. We have one price out there, but it goes through a distributor. That's a much more practical way for us to distribute our products is through distributors. But you should generally see them priced in about the same range.
Okay, and I'm guessing it's like price-wise, it's like in between, I'm trying to think of Elmhurst. I can't think of a brand,
yeah.
like
well,
Elmhurst,
priced,
which is...
Yeah, it's
and,
priced between conventional and organic, that's right.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's not as, it's like closer to the price of organic than it is to the store brand, say.
Actually, we really try to keep it in the middle.
Yeah.
So
oh, okay.
It's you know, because we really want it to be within reach. We really want it to be within reach. When it gets too close to organic, it becomes very expensive. Because we also think that if regular milk and organic milk were the same price, well, everyone would just buy organic milk. And
true.
I wonder why that is. And so they're obviously, but they don't. In fact, only 6 to 8% of the population—that's 6 to 8% of all the milk sold is organic. So, the only problem must be that it's a price. It's out of reach for people, and so we think if we can have a product certainly equal in its stature and how people think about local, which they think local is in a very positive light, but often is a higher quality than any milk out there, and have a price in the middle, then we can really. Gain a lot of customers and help a lot of farmers.
Okay. Well, I'm going to do some experimenting. Perhaps at some point, if I'm having some difficulties in doing that, we can have your chef call.
Great.
and assist me on this, or at least... assist me so that I can get the articles done. I think I put this up so far. Oh, yeah, I threw this up on my Facebook already.
Well, thank you. That's great. That's great.
About
well,
the experience of having the non-fat milk. You know, OMG, it tastes like milk. So now I just have to, I'll get the word out. And Fairway will be very happy because, like, from what I'm getting, that seems to be the only place in Queens County that has it.
We're slowly starting to build our presence in Queens. We started out in Brooklyn and Manhattan, and now we're getting to Queens and the Bronx. So you'll start to see it in more places.
Okay. In the meantime, I don't mind promoting Fairway. I like them anyway. So,
oh, great. Well, Mo, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. And thank you for sharing this information. When I get off the phone, I'll probably have another shot of milk, you know. It's just a matter of which one. all right. Have a great day. And thanks again.
Okay. Bye.
Bye. Yes, milk. I just love milk. So, I'm going to end the show early, having done three this week. Wow. I will definitely have one show next week, in between, is another press trip that I will tell people about. So, in the meantime, everybody, have a oh the chickens. Oh, well, they didn't. They don't lay eggs, and they don't get laid. So I don't think they really wanted to be a part of the show today, but that's okay. We didn't talk about eating chicken. We just, you know, just did. Oh, okay. Anyway. Goodbye, everybody.